Welcome back to Minds Matter, a podcast sponsored by the Monash Center for Consciousness and Contemplative Studies. I'm Ava.
And I'm Beth. And on Minds Matter, we discuss research from neuroscience to psychology whilst occasionally talking through our own personal experiences.
This week on the podcast, I spoke to Dr. Haley Dorfman, who is a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard University. And Haley's research looks at how our beliefs about ourselves and the world around us shape how we learn and make decisions. And we talk a little bit in this episode about how that might influence mental health as well. And two big frameworks to keep in mind up front that we'll be talking about right at the beginning are reinforcement learning and Bayesian inference. So Haley will get into those two frameworks and talk about how they help us understand how people learn from reward and feedback, and also how their internal representations, especially sense of control, shape how people make decisions and learn.
My name is Haley Dorfman. I'm a postdoctoral fellow in the psychology department at Harvard University. My research is focused on how people's beliefs about themselves and the world influence their learning and decision-making, and how learning and decision-making processes differ across individuals and contribute to things like mental health. So when we think about how people learn and make decisions, we probably most often think about them responding directly to things in their environment. I take an action out in the world, I receive an outcome. Simple. But we know that people actually have these rich internal representations that also influence their behavior. And these internal representations, so things like your emotions or your sense of control, what we call agency, are especially difficult for the person experiencing them and us as researchers to report and measure. And it's the influence of these types of hidden experiences on learning and decision making that I find most interesting.
Could you describe the two frameworks that you primarily work with of reinforcement learning and Bayesian inference before we jump into how you apply these in your research?
Broadly speaking, both reinforcement learning and Bayesian inference rely on principles of prediction and updating. In reinforcement learning, an agent is learning about choices, actions, or associations between stimuli in an environment by keeping track of those choices or actions and updating them in response to feedback. If I have an existing value of a choice, I then choose that option, I receive feedback. Then I would take the prediction error, which is the difference between the actual feedback I received and the expected feedback I received, and I can modulate that by the magnitude of learning or the learning rate. Then I use this value, the difference between my expected and actual feedback, to update the value of my choice. And I can keep doing that over and over again as I learn about these different options. But another way that we might go about making predictions when we're in more uncertain situations is to use our past experiences or knowledge to guide us. Psychologists and neuroscientists have proposed the brain might be making these predictions using a process of Bayesian inference. Bayesian inference is where you combine your prior predictions or your beliefs with incoming evidence, which we call the likelihood, to update your current view of the world, which we call the posterior. And one example that I like to give that can be related to some of the work that I do is if you're thinking about playing a game of Jenga, where you have to take turns removing those little blocks from a tower of blocks, and the goal is to avoid having the tower fall. When you take an action and receive an outcome, you also have to make an inference about the extent to which you caused the outcome. So that, say, you remove a block and the tower comes crashing down, was that entirely your fault? And what inference are you going to make there? And if you have a strong prior belief that you're clumsy, then your posterior belief about the cause of the fallen blocks would sit close to that prior belief. It would take more evidence, for example, seeing the table wobble as you're taking your turn, to shift that posterior closer to the likelihood. Reinforcement learning frameworks do a really good job at describing a huge variety of human behavior. But where standard reinforcement learning models might need a little help is when we start thinking about how to explain people's beliefs about things that are a bit harder to directly quantify, can influence how they're going to interpret feedback they receive or choices that they make. Things like our beliefs about agency or how much control we think we have, things like our affective experiences, like when we feel physically jittery or anxious, and even things like other people's emotions or opinions. It's these types of inferences that we know influence learning and decision making, but we're not yet certain exactly how. So using other types of computational models like Bayesian inference frameworks to test ways that these things can account for these latent or hidden factors in our learning processes is a potentially useful way to look at how different individuals might approach a learning or decision-making problem that's maybe not as straightforward.
So in terms of the things that are a little bit harder to quantify, like social interaction or information or emotions, are those the reward in the framework of reinforcement learning, or are they the things that kind of influence the way that you're taking the reward into account?
That's a good question. I think it depends on what your question is, what you're trying to test, and how you're conceptualizing these things. In my work, we're kind of coming at things by thinking about this Bayesian inference framework that's interacting with this reinforcement learning framework. And so in our case, we put those things in this Bayesian inference pile, which is then modulating this reinforcement learning structure. So you could flip that around any way you want. But for us, I think of those things as harder to quantify things that you're making inferences about. So therefore, having a Bayesian belief updating process for those processes tends to make intuitive sense to me. Then looking at how those things modulate this underlying more basic reinforcement learning structure when you're going to make decisions. Of course, your rewards in those contexts can be social, right? Or they can be emotional as well. But we're really trying to explain, how are you actually computing these beliefs about these things? And then how is that modulating things like learning or how you're interpreting reward in a particular environment?
Since we've built up to this idea of pairing reinforcement learning and Bayesian inference, could you talk about your 2019 paper and describe the task and the methods that you use there?
There's a lot of research in both humans and animals looking at how people learn from good relative to bad outcomes, positive things, rewards, and bad things, typically punishments or the loss of money, things of that nature. But these findings have been somewhat inconsistent, with some researchers concluding that people learn more from positive feedback and others concluding that people learn more from negative feedback. The goal of some of my PhD research was to figure out what might be driving these different results that people were finding. In that 2019 paper, we were interested in trying to resolve some of these inconsistencies in the literature about what might be driving these valence asymmetries, differences between good and bad, that we tend to see often in feedback learning. Our hypothesis was that one thing that might contribute to these asymmetries is the extent to which someone believes they have control over feedback, or what we refer to as agency. We developed a gamified variation of a reinforcement learning task where we tell participants they're going to be mining in the Wild West. And on every trial, they have to choose between two different options or mines. So when they choose a mine, they get feedback, either a positive outcome that earns them some bonus money, or a negative outcome, which results in a loss of bonus money, which we represent with images of either gold or rocks to keep up with this gamified task. The participant's ultimate goal is to learn through trial and error which of these mines is going to produce more gold, so give them more money. We also have participants play this game in three different conditions or mining territories in which we manipulate their beliefs about agency. In one of our task conditions, we tell participants that there's a generous tycoon. This tycoon will sometimes interfere with the feedback they receive because he's going to put extra gold into the mines. In another territory, there's a sneaky bandit who will interfere with feedback by putting more rocks in the mines. And in a third condition, there's a neutral sheriff who tries to redistribute rocks and golds in the mines equally. So what this means for our participants is that they won't always know whether the feedback they're receiving is due to their own choices or due to interference by one of these three characters. This allows us to manipulate people's beliefs about agency in different ways in each of these three conditions and test whether we can move around how much people learn from good compared to bad feedback, depending on when they do or do not believe they have agency over these particular types of outcomes. What we ultimately find in this study is a few things. One thing is that we can show that as we're manipulating agency, that's enough in the short context of this game on a computer. Even in this context, we can move around people's beliefs about agency fairly simply just by telling them about these different environmental situations. And two, that by manipulating their beliefs in this way, we can create these learning asymmetries between positive and negative feedback and move it around in the context of our task, thereby showing that at least one of the factors that might be contributing to these asymmetries in learning that people see in these types of tasks is due to how much agency someone believes they have. So for example, in the tycoon condition of our study, where you have this benevolent agent who's interfering to give you gold, what that does for people is it gives them a way to explain away when they're getting positive feedback. You can't always be certain that you caused a gold outcome in this condition, but can be certain that when you receive a rock outcome or a negative outcome, that it was your choice that led you to getting that outcome. You should inherently see this asymmetry if people are abiding by the causal structure of the task and their beliefs about agency in the task. We should see this asymmetry where they're learning more in that condition from negative outcomes than from positive outcomes. And that is indeed what we see. And we see the reverse in the tycoon condition. And of course, people vary individually the extent to which they do that. But in this particular study, we were really interested in just having this proof of concept. It's not just about valence. It's not just about whether people inherently care more about positive and negative outcomes. It's also about this idea of agency. And we can move this around in the context of this really short task. In a lot of the samples of people that we've had do this task over the years, we tend to find, not always, but generally, that people overall, even though they show these asymmetries in learning, tend to learn more from positive outcomes compared to negative outcomes. And that's in line with a lot of prior research about things like optimism biases and self-serving biases, where you think you cause good things more often than bad things. So not hugely surprising, but nice to be able to reiterate, but also to show it's not just about that, right? We can also manipulate this learning by looking at agency beliefs and by manipulating those. And then the final thing that we did in this paper was we constructed a computational model to quantify our hypotheses about how we think this process is happening. In our model, we have a number of variations of models that we test and another number of different models that we compare to each other to try to determine which one's best. Our baseline hypothesis model is a Bayesian reinforcement learning model, so it integrates both theories of Bayesian inference and belief updating with very standard reinforcement learning mechanisms. And it says, okay, this is how we think people are generating and updating dynamically their beliefs about agency in this task. And we're going to explain that through a process of Bayesian inference. And we're going to then take those beliefs and have them modulate the learning rates in different ways in our different conditions to create asymmetries in learning. Our hypothesis is that we will see these asymmetries and then test that against the data to see if it's a good fit for what's actually happening in behavior. And so that was the kind of final finding for that particular study. People seem to be doing a process of Bayesian inference or approximate Bayesian inference on their agency beliefs that are then dynamically influencing their learning rates and creating these patterns and these bias patterns between learning from good versus bad.
So one thing I was kind of surprised about when I was reading the paper was this idea that people were learning more from positive than negative outcomes. And I probably shouldn't have been surprised by this because my co-host actually works on the optimism bias, so I should know that. We've talked about it many times.
But I think because I've worked for some amount of time in intergroup relations and trait perception and areas like that, there's this idea that bad is stronger than good. And I just was interested in getting your take on what are the cases in which people are more likely to learn from these positive outcomes, and what are the cases in which people are more likely to actually take those negative outcomes to heart more. Is it because the target of the learning was them causing something good or bad to happen? And if they were, rather than learning about the outcomes that they caused, if the target of the learning was actually the bandit versus the tycoon and trying to figure out who was good and who was bad, quote unquote, that they would have learned more fast about that bandit who was causing these problems rather than the tycoon. And so they would be learning about an other target more so if they were negative. And for themselves, it's more that we want to take that positive learning to heart more for ourselves.
So that's what we think is happening. It's interesting. We don't always see it. And not every individual has that optimism bias either, where they're learning more from good overall compared to bad. And of course, there's all sorts of examples in the literature. My advisor now in my postdoc, Liz Phelps, studies fear learning and has for the majority of her career. Fear learning is an incredibly quick learning process. People do tend to learn very well from fearful circumstances. So what we're trying to say here is that it's not just about valence, right? In general, if you collapsed across a certain type of task across a huge sample, you probably would see this optimism bias. And there's tons of literature on that. People tend to be overall more optimistic and attribute good outcomes to themselves more often, this self-serving bias. But it's not true for everyone. And those individual differences are really important for predicting things like depression, for example. It can change depending on the context, which is probably why the literature has sort of been finds both of these things to be true, right? It really depends on a host of factors. But the reason why I think agency is so interesting is that it offers up a kind of really intuitive example of something that we're making inferences about all the time that has a huge impact on the way that we're learning whether something is worth attending to, whether something should be discounted or not, right? If I take a test in my class and get a bad grade, is that because I didn't study enough or because the professor was a hard grader? People get the same feedback from that situation and interpret it in totally different ways. It's completely my fault that I didn't study enough. And someone else might say, well, I don't need to worry about that. That professor graded really hard. There's nothing I can do. I can't possibly have agency over it. And that can lead to completely different trajectories in the way that people learn and behave, and also just their general view of the world and well-being.
Are there some more adaptive priors than others? Like, is it better to think of yourself as in the situation with the tycoon or with the bandit, or does it really depend on other contextual factors?
It's a really good question. When thinking about agency, it's probably better, and why we see things like self-serving bias and optimism bias emerge. It is probably more adaptive to have a feeling of agency. For example, there's older work in the clinical field about something called depressive realism, where they find that people with depression aren't more pessimistic, they're more realistic in terms of the availability of rewards and punishments in the world. People who don't have depression are actually overly optimistic. So they are kind of overestimating in an incorrect way how good things are in the world. So in that sense, thinking good things are more likely is perhaps more adaptive in that it buffers against things like depression. And I think you can make a similar argument for agency. You know, it's good to go out and learn and get feedback. We want to have that motivation, right? If you feel like, well, there's nothing that I possibly have control over, you know, then you start to see things like learned helplessness, for example, in some of the animal literature, where the animals, after experimenters purposely have them learn that they can't have control over negative outcomes, they end up giving up. And so that's often used as a model for things like anhedonia and depression and in things like trauma, where if you feel like you can't possibly control or stop bad things from happening to you, then you don't have any motivation for action or for learning or for gathering feedback at all. And that's not very adaptive. On the flip side, you could also imagine situations where maybe you don't want too much agency. For example, thinking about things like superstitions, right? That's what I think of as people having maybe an abundance of agency that in some cases is harmless, but maybe in other cases might lead to mental health outcomes or experiences in someone's life that aren't that beneficial for them. So thinking that, well, I have complete control over the weather, or, you know, a kind of innocuous example is your sports team winning because you wore your lucky socks that day. That's harmless. So it doesn't really matter maybe that you have what we might see as like an excess of agency in that instance. But there could be other instances where maybe that tendency goes a little too far, right? Maybe you start getting into beliefs that might be associated more with obsessive compulsive disorder or psychosis and schizophrenia, where you're believing, you know, that nursery rhyme, step on the crack, break your mother's back, right? You start to have these obsessions about having control over things that you don't have control over, but that torment you or make you worried or not feel good. In that sense, I think it's a balance of finding the best kind of in between of being more agentic or less agentic. And it also depends on the context and the situation. So it's a complicated thing.
Yeah, I think it depends on the actual environment as well. Like if someone is in a situation where they live with a lot of privilege and have everything given to them, then being adapted to that can be great. But then if that's no longer the case, that might not be so good anymore. So we've talked a little bit about some individual differences and ways that people might differ in these types of feedback that they're learning from. But you've also done some developmental work that actually gets at this question of, are people learning the same way across childhood and early adulthood, or are there some changes?
Yeah, this paper was spearheaded by Ali Cohen and Kate Nussenbaum, who at the time were in Kate Hartley's lab. So all the credit goes to them. We were interested in trying to figure out, okay, we know that these asymmetries in learning exist, that they can be modulated by agency. But one of the questions I've been interested in for a long time is how these biases come about, particularly biases in agency. Do they change over time? How do they kind of emerge? Is this a developmental process? And so what Ali and Kate did was they ran a very slightly modified version of our task in a developmental sample. So they had children, adolescents, and young adults all complete this task. And there's a lot of wonderful findings from that study. But one of the main findings, and I think one of the more interesting findings, is that children, adolescents, and adults were using three distinct learning processes when they're doing this task. Much like the adults in our prior study, the young adults in this study were best fit by the same model that we found in our previous study. To give some background, we had a few variations of our Bayesian reinforcement learning model. The variation that won out in our previous study is what I like to call the Bayesian-ish reinforcement learning model. It takes into account this dynamic belief updating process about agency that modulates the learning rates in the reinforcement learning component of our model. It also uses this biased prior over agency as a starting point. How we do that is in the task, we have people give their subjective judgments of whether they think they caused an outcome or not after every trial. In our baseline version of this Bayesian reinforcement learning model, we don't need to use those subjective judgments to calculate this Bayesian belief updating process over agency. We have it kind of as a test. to make sure that our values in that model are correlated with the values that people are consciously reporting about their agency. And it does correlate. But importantly, what we needed to do for the adults in our first study to get this model to be the best fitting model for them to explain their behavior, we needed to make it a little bit more biased. So we used those subjective judgments they were making about agency and the task. We took the average of them and used that as our starting point for that belief updating process. So what that ends up doing mathematically is constraining the space of these agency beliefs to each of these individuals in the way that's like most biased for them. And that's the best fitting model for our adults in that 2019 study and in our young adult group. What's interesting is that it's not the best fitting model for the adolescents or the children. Adolescents are best fit by our pure Bayesian reinforcement learning model that doesn't need those subjective judgments about agency. It just generates them on its own, and we can use sort of a neutral starting point for those prior beliefs. The significance of that in the most simplified way is that we can say that those adolescents are kind of doing the most pure Bayesian inference process. In other words, they're the most flexible. They're not coming in with these more extreme biases about their beliefs about agency. They're just learning on the fly as our model predicts they would do. Whereas our adults have this more biased attitude towards agency that we need to account for in our model in order to get it to fit their data best. What's really interesting about the children in our study is that they seem to be able to explicitly report the causal structure of the tasks when they're reporting those beliefs about, did the tycoon cause this? Did the bandit cause this? Did you cause this? They're able to report beliefs in line with, again, the structure or the instructions that we're giving them in the task. So they're able to say, yes, I understand that the bandit is giving me sometimes negative outcomes and that I cause the good outcomes. And yes, I can report that the tycoon is sometimes causing good outcomes. And so in that condition, I'm causing bad outcomes, et cetera. But they don't seem to be using those beliefs in their learning process. They're using a simple reinforcement learning process without any Bayesian updating of their agency beliefs. This is actually kind of in line with a lot of other work that some developmental psychologists and Kate Hartley's lab included have done that kind of show this trajectory where younger children are able to represent these more complicated concepts about things like agency, but they don't necessarily integrate them into their learning processes. And adolescents are also frequently shown to be the most flexible in their learning processes. And then, of course, we have our adults who tend to be a little bit more biased. We're seeing this really interesting trajectory where it seems like adaptively as a child, you're kind of like, okay, I understand that these other things are happening, but I just need to learn the basics here, right? Good and bad, like what's going on? How do I update according to this? I understand these other things are at play, but I'm not going to integrate them now. I'm not saying these are conscious processes, but just kind of to simplify a bit. Adolescents are in this time of their life where it's actually quite adaptive to be a flexible learner. And so we see that here as well. They're just saying, I'm not going to come in with any biases at all. I'm going to take what's given to me at face value and adapt quickly to these different circumstances. And then perhaps over time, as you age, you start to learn things about the world and about yourself that you start to hold as beliefs or certainties about the world. And so therefore, in our adults, we kind of see this emergence of maybe a bias, an agency bias or learning biases. And so that's what I think is most interesting about this study that we didn't necessarily expect to see.
So do these findings suggest that kids have less of a sense of agency than adults?
Subjectively, yes. Kids do overall report, in our task anyway, less agency in the sense that their attributions towards these other agents are much higher on average than the attributions that, for example, adolescents and adults make. So in that sense, yes, they do tend to have less agency. They're like more extreme in those attributions is another way to interpret that. So they're like the bandit, he's always doing all the bad stuff. You know, the tycoon's always doing all the good stuff. And that tends to be what those graphs look like. That said, it's not necessarily the case that they don't have any agency, right? They understand that in certain circumstances they do. So they're understanding, okay, in the bandit condition, when it's gold, I should attribute that to myself. They are explicitly asked, here's your positive outcome. Did you cause this outcome or did the bandit cause this outcome? In that circumstance, they're perfectly capable of saying, I caused that outcome, because they know that the bandit doesn't cause good outcomes. He causes bad outcomes. So they do have agency. They definitely do. And they definitely understand how that agency is changing within the structure of the task that they're doing. It's just that they don't use it for learning. So when they're trying to determine which of these minds is better, they don't seem to be integrating it.
So those beliefs about agency are kind of disconnected from what they're learning and therefore maybe all the actions that they're taking.
Yes.
It seems like for the older adults, this makes a lot of sense because this goes with kind of that folk psychology belief that people get stuck in their ways and then that they're just coming into these tasks already with these biases. Do you think that that's part of why in those past studies there were differences in whether people learned more from a good or bad outcome, like that just the samples were different and just by chance have some people who happen to be more optimistic or pessimistic?
I mean, that's definitely a reason. And that's a question I'm interested in, right? Is individual differences matter and people's optimism and pessimism and the biases they're coming into something with are really important for what they end up learning. And so, yeah, that's what I think is the interesting part. It's not that these studies were finding, in some cases, more learning from positive or more from negative. We know it's true. It's just that maybe it was the sample of people. Maybe it was the context that they were in or the types of rewards or punishments they were receiving. There's so many different factors that could be contributing to when and where we see these types of valence asymmetries. But agency is at least one of those factors. I hope we've shown and convinced people that it's at least one of those factors that can move these asymmetries around.
So because individual differences are so important, do you think, one, that that computational model approach allows us to get at those individual differences because everyone gets those parameters fitted? And then second, in general, what do you kind of think about the fact that in psychology, most of the stuff that we do is really averaging over these huge groups of people and in some ways just trying to wash out those individual differences?
I mean, I think both things are important. So I think it's important to look at patterns generally, and it's also important to look at things individually in psychology. Those things serve different purposes, right? When we start to think about psychopathology in particular, it's really important to be thinking about individual differences. Computational modeling can sometimes be helpful for looking at individual differences. That said, even as someone who is a computational modeler, I think that you can often get at individual differences just through behavior too. I wouldn't say that a computational model always goes above and beyond the behavior. What I really think computational models are useful for is specifying a process, a hypothesis for what you think is happening. This approach is maybe a bit of a newer approach. Previously, a lot of computational modeling, at least within our field of psychology and cognition, was focused on fitting models that were mostly similar to each other, finding the best fitting one, and then seeing how a particular parameter varied across individuals. And that's very useful. What's interesting about this developmental paper and a number of other papers that have been coming out more recently is when you're thinking about different populations of people, so whether that's age related or people within different mental health categories, for example, it's useful, I think, to think about how can different models explain their behavior? Models that are completely really not related to each other. Modeling can be more useful for thinking about individual differences if we're not only thinking about extracting a parameter from one model, but thinking about, well, it's totally possible that children are doing a completely different learning process than adults. And how are we going to model that? And getting at those individual differences through modeling, I think, has been and will continue to be a really useful path to take.
So we've talked about all of these different processes from kind of this cognitive perspective, but you do have a 2021 study where you take all the things that we've been talking about, but looked at it with a neural aspect as well. So did brain imaging at the same time. Could you tell us a little bit about that study and what you found?
In this paper, we were interested in taking the same task I described and trying to figure out where in the brain these processes might be represented and how they might be interacting with each other. So took a sample of adults in this case and put them in the fMRI scanner and had them complete a version of this task while being scanned. And I'll highlight some of the more relevant findings. One thing that computational modeling can be really useful for, especially when you're doing things like imaging, is because you're specifying your hypotheses in this really specific quantifiable way, you can then test whether the quantities of your model are even biologically plausible. For example, if you are trying to see whether a parameter of your model is correlated with brain activity and you don't find anything, that might tell you maybe this particular piece of this model isn't represented in the brain and therefore is maybe not what is going on in this particular process. So that's one motivation for putting a task like this in the scanner. The other, of course, is to see what components of the model are acting in which regions of the brain and how they're intertwined with each other. We were really interested in looking at regions in the striatum. In particular, we know that regions of the striatum are responsible for encoding prediction errors when we're doing reinforcement learning. But we also know that the striatum has been shown to integrate these reward processes with actions. For example, two different regions of the striatum, both ventral and dorsal regions, have been shown to be sensitive to things like controllable versus uncontrollable outcomes. And we think this integration might arise from these functional distinctions within these subregions of the striatum. So typically, these subregions are split into more ventral regions like the nucleus accumbens, and then more dorsal regions like the caudate and putamen. And so we hypothesized that these learning signals happening in our task, represented by a subset of our model, specifically these agency-related learning signals, might be represented in action-dependent regions of the striatum, so more dorsal regions. Learning signals not related to agency might be represented in these more ventral regions, so these more action-independent regions. And I won't go into all the technical details of how we did this, but we essentially compared regions of activation in the striatum between the quantity of our model that can account for these just standard prediction errors, so this standard learning, and a quantity of our model that represents prediction errors that are influenced by agency inference. So again, because our model is integrating both a reinforcement learning framework with a Bayesian framework, we can then start to take it apart and see which pieces are represented where. That's the general idea. And we find a graded pattern of this prediction error representation across the striatum. So where we do find that these more agency-modulated prediction errors are represented in these action regions of the striatum, and standard prediction errors are represented in these action-independent, more ventral areas of the striatum. And so that was one of our main findings, but one of the findings that I thought was most interesting is that we also wanted to see, okay, we have this parameter in our model that represents this probability of belief about agency, given the feedback that you're receiving. We wanted to identify regions of the brain that tracked with this parameter. Is there a region in the brain that's computing beliefs about agency, essentially? We found that this parameter is associated with activation in both an area called the right anterior insula and the right inferior frontal gyrus. We were excited about this finding because some previous work from our lab and colleagues have shown these same regions pop up when we've used other Bayesian computational models to quantify behavior in tasks that are different yet very computationally related to our current task. And so, for example, we've seen activation in these same regions in a study where people made inferences about causal relationships between cues and contexts and outcomes. We also see similar regions pop up in a study where people made inferences about how similar they are to other group members. We also know from a lot of previous work that the anterior insula and the IFG have been shown to be associated with things like self-referential processes and self-related processes. One possible thing that this evidence might suggest is that these regions might be representing inferences about the structure of the environment around us by calculating, integrating, and comparing information using the self as a reference point. So in any situation where I need to think back to, okay, how much agency do I have in this situation? It seems like these regions tend to be active. That's probably not the only thing these regions are doing. They show up in all sorts of studies for a variety of reasons, but it was nice to see this converging evidence, and converging computational evidence suggests that maybe that's what's going on here.
When I was listening to this, I just wanted to say shout out to Haley for making the modeling so clear. I think it was one of the best descriptions of reinforcement learning I've heard. I actually am in the middle of writing up my thesis on optimism and modeling. So, yeah, I sigh because writing a thesis is hard. But I guess one of the things I've been thinking about in my thesis is something that Haley also addressed, which I really like, is do we learn more from good things or do we learn more from bad things? And just this notion of, well, it's context and it's different scenarios, different settings. Our models change depending on what context we're in. If we're going to be in a car crash, we're going to learn from that bad information. It's not like even if we have optimism, we'll be only learning from good in those scenarios. So I've actually been writing a lot and thinking about that at the moment. And I feel like thinking about it in that way has, I guess, some of our discussions in science is, well, you know, what is it? Is it this or that? What's the answer? And what I like about modeling is that it just kind of acknowledges that, yeah, there isn't going to be one thing and there never is, and that's okay. And I think you just get a better picture of the brain and who we are.
I think the inclination with this type of work and all science work and psychology, and especially as a science communicator, is to be like, okay, what is the take-home message from this? And what is the right way to do things? I feel like it's hard to not automatically want to ask, like, what should I try to be striving for? Yeah. And I think the flexibility is something that you know, obviously makes sense given different situations, and because people's environments are going to be really different, right? So I think we mentioned in the episode as well, like some people live in the mine where there's a benevolent tycoon giving you gold all the time. And some people live in the place where there's a bandit taking their stuff and like it's really hard to get the gold that they want. And we didn't touch on this as much, but to learn through time different ways of relating to your environment and how you should be learning. And I think that that's a really interesting avenue to think about. I think the flexibility aspect as well. And I was really trying to figure out, like, when are we learning more from good and bad? But I was wondering if you feel like you have experiences, because I know you're an optimist, but if there are times where you feel that the bad is stronger than the good.
I mean, I think there's like a threshold where it crosses and it's like,
yeah.
So remember my bus crash story? I feel like that. Yeah. I feel like I always, when I think about situations where I learn from the bad, I go back to that, because that's just like that instant survival response. And you just have to learn from the bad because you have to work out what to do and to get out. And I noticed a long time after that, my model was still learning. I was like terrible in the car because I was still learning.
So you got into a bus crash and then you felt stressed every time you were in a vehicle.
Because you were like, oh, which was really exhausting.
Yeah.
I'm over it now, but.
In the bus all the time.
But I think it was like that triggered that like context switch for me. But I definitely feel it's like for me, those really extreme examples when I learn from more from the bad. Otherwise, everything else, I'm just out there learning from the good and maybe sometimes to my detriment.
Well, that's true, because also within, I think in the task that Haley was using, maybe if there were a situation where you actually take a big loss, then you might be more averse, which is more of that kind of fear conditioning that she was talking about that people in her lab have done as well. And I think there is something to be said about the threshold, because if it's just like, oh, I'll keep doing it and I don't lose anything, I don't gain anything, the only thing I lose is some time, then I think that's very different than I almost died in a bus crash.
Yeah, when we're thinking about these tasks, I do always think it's interesting, and this comes up in my work, is like, well, what is the loss? And I think unless you're doing fear conditioning work, maybe in a task, you can't really model how people react to those true losses and like bus crashes or other tragedies that can unfold. But for me, otherwise, I'm just learning from the good. What about you? I feel like you're mid.
I think it really depends on the context. It's hard to say because I don't know if I can bucket it, because I'm thinking about the type of feedback that we get the most is like academic related feedback.
And do you do well with criticism in that way?
I actually think it depends a lot on the source, because I think I do well with criticism actually when it comes from an advisor or someone that I'm asking for feedback, mm-hmm. who's only in a work capacity. But sometimes like if I ask my partner to give me feedback on a paper and then he's like, oh, maybe you should change this, I'm like, oh, what the heck?
Yeah, like, who do you think you are?
Yeah, who do you think you are? And I get, like, very defensive. So I think for me, it really depends on the source. And I don't know. There's, like, if we were to model that, I think there's some deeper things from that I haven't worked through yet. But I think for me, criticism very much depends on the source. And maybe if I feel that the source of the criticism is aligned with the specific target in my life.
I also have noticed that lots of the feedback I get now, this isn't just in academia, but I have this example of, I recorded this video of dolphins recently.
Yeah.
And I sent it to so many people and they're all just like, that's so beautiful. Oh, we love dolphins. Beautiful. Yay. Woo. Completely enabling my love of this video. And I sent it to another friend and he was like, that's beautiful, Beth, but like the quality, we can't see any dolphins. And I just thought it was so funny that all of my friends and community give me positive feedback when maybe it's not even.
Whoa. Does that make you feel like you didn't have control over the situation?
I think that was just, first of all, I thought it was funny that only one person was like, I can't see the dolphins.
Yeah.
But then what's my reality then? If I do, like, sending out really mediocre photos and videos to people of nature and they're just like, whoa, yeah, go Beth. And it's just,
I think in these studies, there was no exploration of choosing your environment.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm obviously choosing.
You like with the task they had, you would want the I actually think it's an interesting question. Like, would you want the tycoon? There's probably some individual differences in who would want a situation in which you're getting things that you're not actually in control of, that just you're not really choosing what you're getting from the mind because someone else is intervening. But I think there is something to be said about like the co-construction of the way that you learn and what you're choosing to get feedback from. Obviously, sometimes you don't have a choice, but I think that especially if you're an optimist, you're going out and doing things and like shaping your environment.
Because I guess I sent the video because I wanted people to share in my joy of the dolphins. And I suppose, does that really matter if they can see them or not? I don't know.
Exactly. I agree. It's like getting someone a gift. It's the thought that counts.
So to wrap up, could you just tell us what you are working on next and what you're excited about that's coming up?
My postdoc advisor, Liz Phelps, is primarily an affective neuroscientist. In some of my recent work, I'm really excited to look at how things like emotions influence decision-making and learning. It fits into my general interests about how we make inferences about unknowable things and how those kind of unknowable or unquantifiable or uncertain things influence our decision-making and learning. We're doing a number of new studies that I'm excited about. One study in particular we're interested in that's also looking at agency-related processes is we want to see whether affective arousal, so when you get very jittery or anxious or scared and you have that kind of feeling, how that influences your sense of agency and how that experience might move around how much agency you believe you have, and also how it is represented differently in different people. And so just as a very brief overview, we're doing a threat of shock manipulation where we use very safe electrodermal stimulation to someone's wrist, so just a small electric shock to their wrist. That's a very reliable way to induce this aversive feeling of anxiety. We can do that in a controlled way in the lab and then do different tests and tasks where people are judging their sense of agency or indicating how much agency they believe they have. We can see under conditions where they don't have this anxious feeling and where they do have this anxious feeling, how that's moving around their beliefs about agency. And again, we're very interested to see not only whether this changes across different emotional situations, but also are some people more resilient to this type of emotional manipulation in terms of their beliefs about agency, and are other people perhaps less resilient? On kind of the flip side of that, some people have kind of more robust beliefs about their agency that are harder to move around. Other people have more flexible beliefs about their agency that are easier to move around, given kind of emotional circumstances. And we are really interested in these types of questions because of their relationship to certain mental health outcomes like anxiety and depression.
Thank you to Dr. Haley Dorfman for joining us this episode.
Our intro and outro music is Nobody Stayed for the DJ by Glacio. Our transition music is Back for More, also by Glacio. Minds Matter is mixed, edited, and created by Beth Fisher, she's the Australian one, and me, Ava Montesouza. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a brand new episode, but in the meantime, find all our episodes and show notes on mindsmatterpodcast.com.